This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of May 5th, 2005.
All right, police!
Bad Cop No Donut!
Bad.
Cop.
No. Donut!
It's under law, and I rule!
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. Stay tuned after this week's headlines for an interview with Christina Agola, a lawyer in New York who is representing two women who were violated by police in East Rochester, New York, and who are now suing the police and the city. But first, let's have a look at what the police did to us this week. A police officer in Birmingham, Alabama, was sentenced to 22 years in prison this week for forcing a 12-year-old boy to have sex with him. An Associated Press account says that Officer Todd Easterwood was found guilty in February of first-degree sodomy. The sexual abuse of the boy was alleged to have taken place over a 3-year period. Easterwood plans to appeal his conviction. A police officer in Hilltown, Pennsylvania, has been arrested for repeatedly raping a boy over a 6-year period, starting when his victim was only 11 years old. A report from the Bucks County Courier-Times says that Officer James Glenn Kane allegedly admitted to raping the boy hundreds of times, often while he was in uniform. Police reports say the crimes were committed between 1996 and 2003, mostly at the officer's home. Kane has been charged with rape of a child, involuntary deviant sexual intercourse, aggravated indecent assault, corruption of minors, endangering the welfare of children, and possession of child pornography. He is being held on $1 million bail.
This guy had stolen my trust. He had stolen my son's innocence. He had taken things from my child that I took for granted.
I'd like to apologize to the victims in this case and their families.
When my child should have been worried about playing with cards and video games, he was telling me about sexualness.
A community safety officer in Columbia, South Carolina, was sentenced last week to 23 years in prison for sexually assaulting 6 elementary school students. According to a report in The State, Officer Donald Porter pleaded guilty to victimizing boys aged 7 to 12 at 2 elementary schools between December 2003 and April 2004. Some of the boys were assaulted in school bathrooms, and others were assaulted in classrooms when teachers were not looking. Porter allegedly used candy, money, and after-school trips to earn the trust of his victims. Columbia police fired the officer after the allegations came to light. Under state law, Porter could be released from prison in 18 years, but could also be held indefinitely for treatment after serving his sentence. A former sheriff's deputy in Hanover County, Virginia, who was also an ordained minister, pleaded guilty last week to sexually abusing 3 young girls. According to the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Gary Reinholtz pleaded guilty to felony aggravated sexual battery and misdemeanor sexual battery involving 2 girls aged 11 and 13. At a separate hearing last week, he pleaded guilty to charges of rape, forcible sodomy, animate object sexual penetration, and aggravated sexual battery involving a 14-year-old who was allegedly violated over a 5-year period. Reinholtz will be sentenced on July 11th. A police officer in Petersburg, Virginia, was sentenced to 9 years in prison last Thursday after admitting to severely beating a man. The Associated Press says that Officer Michael Tweedy pleaded guilty in January to the October 2003 beating, in which he and 3 other officers beat a man so severely that he was in a coma for more than 2 months. Another officer, Michael Perkins, who was found guilty in the beating in February, will be sentenced on May 20th. An autopsy report released this week of a man who was shot by an Otero County, New Mexico sheriff's deputy on December 18th says that the man's body was handcuffed when it arrived at the state medical examiner's office. The Associated Press says that the medical examiner has ruled the death a homicide. State police are investigating whether Deputy Bill Anders subdued and handcuffed his victim before shooting him. The deputy's victim had been shot 4 times, twice in the arm, once in the chest, and once in the forehead. Anders has been on leave since the shooting. A sheriff's deputy in Lee County, Georgia, who was accused of killing a teenager during a traffic stop and then planting a knife in the man's truck to mislead investigators, was charged last week with involuntary manslaughter. According to an Associated Press account, the officer was charged with manslaughter despite the pleas of protesters who demanded a murder charge. A grand jury also indicted Deputy Donnie Spillers on charges of tampering with evidence, making false statements, and violation of oath of office in connection with the February 14th shooting death. No decision has been made about whether or not to charge Spillers' partner, Sergeant Sandra Presley, for her possible role in the incident. A police officer in Chattanooga, Tennessee, who was facing a charge of criminally negligent homicide in a shooting death at a traffic stop, was acquitted by a jury last week. Officer Christopher Gaynor killed a man who he had pulled over for a loud muffler and an expired license tag on May 9, 2003. An investigation showed that the officer shot his victim when he reached into his glove compartment after the officer asked him for his vehicle registration. The police officer claimed that his victim had a gun, but the investigation also revealed that the man was unarmed. Gaynor was fired after the investigation. He now works as a dispatcher for the Hamilton County Sheriff's Department. A police officer in Buffalo, New York, has been accused of helping his cocaine-dealing brother-in-law to steal money from one of his customers. According to the Buffalo News, Officer Ronald Funderburk is accused of taking part in a plot to steal $14,000 while he was on duty, in uniform, and driving a marked police car. A DEA investigation alleges that Funderburk pulled the alleged victim and his brother-in-law over at a time when he knew the man would be carrying a large quantity of cash because they were ostensibly on their way to buy drugs. The officer later split the money with his partner in crime. A felony drug conspiracy indictment was made public last week. The officer has been suspended since August when he was arrested along with 40 other people. The city of Gloversville, New York, settled a lawsuit this week filed by a woman who claims she was falsely arrested and brutalized by police almost 4 years ago. A report in the Gloversville Leader Herald says that in June 2001, the woman went to a police station to inquire about the arrest of her boyfriend and was violently arrested when she attempted to leave. Police had her charged with disorderly conduct, but that charge was later dismissed. The woman, who lives in nearby Fultonville, has settled her lawsuit for $6,000. Two police officers in Roxbury, New Jersey, are facing gambling charges after a raid last weekend. A report from WINS says that 50 officers raided a club in an 8,000-square-foot warehouse, where they seized $27,000 in cash and arrested the two police officers, Richard Winstock and Thomas Juskus, Winstock's wife, who was listed as an owner of the operation in some documents, and another man. All four have been charged with conspiracy, maintaining a gambling report, and promoting gambling. The two police officers were also charged with official misconduct. Both are free after posting $50,000 bail each. A police officer in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was charged last Thursday with misconduct in public office. According to the Associated Press, Officer Nicholas Ince is facing accusations that he forced a woman to perform oral sex on him at a traffic stop instead of arresting her for the drugs he found in her possession. Ince is currently suspended without pay and is free on a $1,000 bond. If convicted, he faces 3.5 years in prison. Another Milwaukee officer was arrested last Wednesday and may face domestic violence charges. The unidentified officer has also been suspended while an investigation of his case continues.
And what I've seen on the video is very disturbing to me. There's no reason to hit anybody who's handcuffed. I just can guarantee that it's going to be a thorough, complete investigation.
They do sometimes just not charge the person in order not to get into an investigation of this kind of thing. Particularly if their initial basis for taking him in was not very serious. That would be a cover-up. If someone's going to do this, the others will usually stand around. They shouldn't. Their duty is to tell him to stop or even to physically restrain him.
We'll let the chips fall where they may. The police department is not going to break the law to enforce the law.
Police in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, were videotaped last Thursday beating a robbery suspect in what some officials are calling a clear use of excessive force. NBC 10 showed a video which showed officers subduing a man and then handcuffing him. Another officer arrives on the scene who appears to hit the man 7 times with a baton or a flashlight. Another officer strikes the man again while he's being taken to a squad car. A police report of the incident says the man was questioned and then released without being charged. The police commissioner in Philadelphia has promised an investigation into the incident. The officers involved in the beating have not been identified, but one is said to be a 10-year veteran of the force assigned to a narcotics unit. At least one of the officers involved in the beating has been placed on administrative leave. Another Philadelphia police officer was arrested for shoplifting last week. An article in the Philadelphia Inquirer says Officer Aileen Kalin was arrested when she stole $300 worth of clothing from a department store. She has been suspended for 30 days and is expected to be fired after that period.
You're talking about a public safety employee that's in a position to arrest people for maybe similar crimes or similar allegations. And I just don't think it's ethical or in best practice to have them in that position.
A police officer in Buckeye, Arizona, who was arrested on a domestic abuse charge a few weeks ago, has had similar trouble in his past. KPHO reports that Officer John Martinez was arrested after he showed up at his ex-girlfriend's house unannounced, verbally abused her, groped her, and then ripped the phone out of the wall when she threatened to call police for help. They also report that he was fired from the Glendale Police Department in 2003 because of another allegation of domestic abuse. A decision to return Martinez to active duty was overturned this week.
He was under the impression that there was an absolute justification for doing so, that it was a violation that was committed within his territory, and so he was acting under good faith.
This was a person that was caught in between being a father and a police officer, and those roles don't mix too well, especially when you're dealing with a highly emotionally charged situation. In this case, it's our position, based on the charges, the unlawful detention, that he didn't have lawful authority to detain her at that point.
The police chief in Camas, Utah, pleaded no contest last week to domestic assault and unlawful detention. According to the park record, Chief Eric Ovard may see the charges dismissed. According to court documents, if Ovard does not break the law again in the next 12 months, pays a $150 fine, and completes an anger management court, the charges against him will be dismissed. The charges stem from an incident on May 3rd where Ovard is accused of choking and handcuffing his adult stepdaughter and then placing her in the back of his squad car. A police officer in Leesburg, Florida, was arrested on a domestic battery charge after sheriff's deputies found his wife handcuffed in their home. The Orlando Sentinel says that Officer Rolando Rangel was arguing with his wife last Monday when the argument escalated into a physical confrontation. At that point, the officer pinned down his wife, handcuffed her, and waited outside the home until sheriff's deputies arrived and released the woman about an hour later. The couple's 3 children, aged 3 to 6, were at home throughout the incident. Rangel was released on bond the day after his arrest and ordered not to have any contact with his wife and to find a new place to live. He is not currently on active duty pending an investigation of the incident. A police officer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who offered no help to a pedestrian lying dying on a roadway, will not be fired over the incident. A report in the South Florida Sun Sentinel says that Officer Keith Kowalski showed extremely poor judgment when responding to a call last May, and that he will be suspended without pay for 16 days, which he can serve over the next 3 months. One of Kowalski's superiors wrote in a memo that Kowalski posed a danger to other officers and to the public. Kowalski was the first officer on the scene where a 68-year-old woman had been hit by a motorcycle and another vehicle after she stepped into the road. The woman eventually died, but was alive when Kowalski arrived. The driver of the motorcycle was also injured in the incident. The officer provided no assistance to either of the injured, failed to protect the accident scene for investigators, failed to direct traffic, failed to talk to witnesses, and failed to speak with the second driver who had hit the woman. Witnesses say the driver of the second vehicle waited for a few minutes and then left the scene of the accident. Kowalski then took 37 minutes to alert other officers to be on the lookout for the motorist, who was never found. The officer has had other troubles in his past. He was suspended for 3 days in 2001 for repeatedly practicing the bagpipes in a local fire hall when he was supposed to be on the job. Kowalski was also disciplined in 2002 for failing to respond to calls on two occasions. In 2003, he was cleared in an investigation of an incident where he kicked a handcuffed and shackled suspect. Two women testified last week that a Harris County, Texas sheriff's deputy offered them money to have sex with him. A report in the Galveston Daily News says that the women were both testifying at the trial of Dale Haig, who is currently on trial for official oppression. One of the women said that Haig slammed her against a car and threatened her with arrest after she swore at him in response to his proposition. If convicted, the deputy could face 1 year in jail, a $4,000 fine, and the end of his employment as a police officer. A female police officer in Houston, Texas, was awarded a $600,000 settlement in her sexual harassment lawsuit against the Houston Police Department. The Houston Chronicle reports that a jury agreed that the officer had been sexually harassed by a superior officer and that her complaint was not properly acted on. The city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, has settled the lawsuit filed by a teenage girl who was partially paralyzed after being shot by a police officer in March 2003. A report from the Tulsa World says that the lawsuit, which was filed in 2003, was settled for $250,000. Tulsa officials had, in the past, said that the shooting was justified and no charges were laid against the officer involved. Officer Steven Sanders is still on active duty and is described by the chief of police as an excellent officer. The original lawsuit described the victim of the shooting as paralyzed from the waist down. Since that time, the girl, who is now 18 years old, has regained some control and feeling in her right leg and is able to move around on crutches. A police officer in Benton, Arkansas, who pleaded guilty to sexual assault in March and was facing a possible 10-year prison term, was sentenced this week to 3 years of probation. The Benton Courier says that Officer Mike Calvin had sex with a woman who had been taken to a local police station after being caught driving while intoxicated in May 2004. He was fired from his job a month later after an investigation of the incident. In addition to the 3 years of probation, Calvin has been ordered to register as a sex offender, pay a $1,000 fine, and perform 200 hours of community service.
I think it's sad that they had to do that to a child.
They should have more training for kids who do have behavior problems. You never know when a child's going to act up.
I don't think it's right whatsoever. I mean, you know, the child should be taken care of as far as that's concerned.
I'm concerned that he was handcuffed. I'm not sure if that was necessary.
Police in Fall River, Massachusetts, handcuffed a 7-year-old last Thursday at his school after he allegedly assaulted 3 teachers and 2 police officers. A Boston Globe report says that officers handcuffed and shackled the boy until one of his parents came to pick him up. The incident was not unlike a videotaped incident in Florida last week where police handcuffed a 5-year-old. In this incident, the 7-year-old now faces charges of assault and battery in juvenile court. The chief of the Falls River Police says that his officers behaved appropriately. On Monday, the city of Boston paid more than $5 million to the family of a female college student who was killed by police during celebrations of the Red Sox pennant win. A source told the Boston Globe last week that the settlement would likely be in the $4 to $7 million range. The woman was killed after she was struck in the eye with a pepper pellet projectile. A homicide investigation of the incident was completed last week, and a decision has not yet been made regarding possible charges for any of the police officers involved in the killing. A sheriff's deputy in Missoula County, Montana, has been suspended after he was caught drinking and driving. An Associated Press article says that Deputy Doug Hartzell was pulled over by Montana Highway Patrol at 3:30 a.m. on Saturday after he allegedly ran a stop sign. Another Missoula officer, Rick Dahlgren, was suspended for 30 days and fined $350 when he was arrested for impaired driving in November 2002. A woman in Denver, Colorado, says that police broke her arm last week while they were checking on the welfare of a child. KMGH reports that officers broke into the woman's home, handcuffed her, and then placed her into a patrol car while they conducted their search. No child was found, but the woman was subsequently treated for a broken arm, which she claimed was the result of rough treatment at the hands of police officers. The woman lives in the building next to one where Denver police killed a bedridden 63-year-old man in July 2004 when an officer mistook a soda pop can in the man's hand for a gun. A police officer in North Aurora, Illinois, has been suspended for lying about damaging a squad car. The Kane County Chronicle reports that Officer Joseph Gorski, who had been suspended with pay since April 7th, was suspended without pay beginning this week, following a vote by the local police commission. A police officer in Farmingham, Minnesota, was sentenced this week for having sex with a 16-year-old girl. According to the Associated Press, Officer Jeremy Buss was sentenced to 4 months in jail and up to 8 years of probation. He was also ordered to pay a $1,200 fine, undergo sex offender treatment, and to register as a predatory offender. Buss resigned from his job in January after he was charged with criminal sexual conduct. The chief of police in Minneapolis, Minnesota, wants to license the city's panhandlers. An Associated Press report claims that Chief William McManus said last week that his proposal would see panhandlers issued a government photo ID. People caught panhandling without displaying the ID badge would be jailed for 30 days or possibly fined. The city already has legislation in place preventing panhandling at bank machines, bus stops, and restrooms. A handful of North American cities already require panhandlers to have licenses, including Dallas, Texas, Cincinnati, Ohio, and Greensboro, North Carolina. A police officer in Winnipeg, Manitoba, who is facing charges of corruption and obstructing justice, has resigned. A broadcast news report says that Officer Bruce Heinen has been on leave since he was arrested last fall in connection with an alleged international ephedrine smuggling ring. His resignation was announced last Friday.
It's not my investigation. It's the OPP's investigation. And I'm sure that they've been through these things many times before. And if Dave Truax doesn't want to tell you what he's here for, it's inappropriate for me to. I've done what I needed to do in terms of this matter. Things were brought to my attention. I've taken the appropriate action. I've asked an independent police service to come in and conduct investigations, and they're doing that.
We fully endorse any investigation by the OPP that will uncover or demonstrate any criminal activity on behalf of any member of the RNC. We are not tolerant of any criminal activity by our members.
The Ontario Provincial Police are conducting two investigations of alleged misconduct by officers of the Royal Newfoundland Constabulary. According to reports from the CBC, few other details are available about the investigations, although one may be linked to an ongoing inquiry into how the justice system dealt with the cases of three men. A source is quoted as saying that the allegations of misconduct in that investigation were of a serious criminal nature. A police officer in Toronto, who is the son of a former Toronto police chief, was arrested again on Tuesday and charged with assault with a weapon and fraud. The Toronto Star says that Bill McCormick Jr. is accused of stealing money that had been raised for the Hospital for Sick Children and of hitting a man with his police radio during a 2004 arrest. McCormick is currently suspended and is also facing charges connected to an RCMP investigation of the shakedown of bars in Toronto's entertainment district by Toronto police officers. He was charged last May with influence peddling and breach of trust. Next up, we'll have a review of this week's Taser News.
The judge did not look at the totality of evidence, and we are very, very disappointed by the approach that a grand jury used.
I think he should have brought those charges as he had told the family, as he had represented to them, and let the grand jury decide.
In fact, we talked about that, in my belief, the odds that the grand jury would indict were really no better than 50-50.
The subject begins to turn around and actively come towards the officer, waving his arms around, tries to hit the officer in the head, and so the officer backs away and uses his city-issued taser. The officer clearly told him, hey, stop.
So one ultimate question is, how safe is this? I mean, I realize it's necessary to arrest people for committing crimes, but we want to be sure we're not executing people at that moment.
A 24-year-old man died shortly after being subdued by police with a taser in Phoenix, Arizona on Tuesday. He is the second person to die after being tasered by Phoenix police. On Tuesday, the victim was tasered repeatedly by Officer Carla Williams and Sergeant Randy Force. A videotape was released this week which shows police in Gwinnett County, Georgia, using a taser on a man 5 times within 1 minute while the man was in handcuffs. Within 4 minutes, the victim was unconscious after pleading with the officers to spare his life, which they did not. The man died days later. This week, a local district attorney decided not to press charges against the officers involved in the incident, and the FBI has been asked to investigate. Ontario's Deputy Chief Coroner, Dr. James Cairns, testified at an inquest in London on Monday that if a person is killed as the result of a taser shock, then the person would die at the time of the shock and not afterwards. The inquest is looking into the death of a man who was killed after being shot with a police taser on May 14, 2004. The man died, as do many victims of taser-related deaths, sometime after he was shocked. The inquest is the first in the province to look into a taser-related death. James Ruggieri, an engineer and taser researcher who we interviewed on this program a little over a month ago, says that the assertion that tasers only kill at the time that the 50,000-volt shock is administered is untrue. Here's an excerpt from that interview.
The science is based on medical research. There were two separate researchers in published medical journals, peer-reviewed medical journals, that came up with those findings with respect to the delayed onset of ventricular fibrillation. What they found in one researcher's case is that he had three individuals who presented symptoms following low-voltage shock across the thoracic region that culminated, delayed, in ventricular fibrillation. In one case, it was up to 12 hours following exposure of an individual to electric shock. In some circles, that has been a widely held belief. However, my research in uncovering those two particular papers, research papers, shows that's not the case, that we can have delayed death or delayed ventricular fibrillation many, many hours following exposure to electric shock or following exposure to a taser. Many coroners now are reevaluating their protocol in determining death due to electric shock, in which case it may result in reevaluation of previous determinations where the taser was precluded based on that fallacy.
An off-duty police officer in Houston, Texas, used a taser on a 14-year-old last Thursday. The unnamed officer was working as a security guard at an apartment complex when he saw the girl chasing another girl with a knife. Two police officers in Halifax, Nova Scotia, who were facing assault charges relating to the misuse of a taser, had their charges downgraded to less serious ones this week. The charges were the result of a complaint filed by a woman who objected to the way she was treated by the police when she was in their custody on September 24, 2004. A misconduct hearing for two Ottawa, Ontario police officers accused of using a taser on a peaceful protester may be called off because of a technical malfunction. A decision is yet to be made on whether to redo parts of the hearing or drop the process altogether after some recording equipment failed to function properly. The recording is a strict requirement of the hearing process. A police officer in Fort Worth, Texas, who used a taser on a man who later died, has been suspended for 16 days. Officer P.R. Ginwaldo was accused of illegally entering an apartment last November and then using a taser on an occupant who later died in police custody. The officer tasered his victim 4 times, with the first shock alone being 10 seconds in length. The Toledo, Ohio branch of the NAACP called this week for a ban on tasers until more research is done on the effects of the weapons. In January, a man died after Toledo police and corrections officers shocked him repeatedly with a taser. A recent study showed that in 65% of incidents where Toledo police used tasers, the victims were black, despite the fact that blacks make up only 25% of the general population. In Austin, Texas, the ACLU is calling for a moratorium on taser use. The Austin City Council, meanwhile, is considering the purchase of 90 new tasers for police there. The police department in Lexington, Kentucky, has decided not to purchase more tasers until more information is available about the health effects of the devices. They will, however, continue to use the 100 tasers they have already purchased. In addition to the deaths already reported in this program, police also killed people this week in St. Petersburg, Florida, Seattle, Washington, Alexandria, Virginia, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Santa Ana, California. Coming up next, we'll listen to an interview I recorded earlier with Christina Agola, a lawyer representing two women in East Rochester, New York, who were brutalized by police in separate incidents. In one of the cases, police are accused of extremely questionable use of a taser, but in both cases, police are accused of unjustifiable use of force.
In or about the second week of October, Teresa Arenas, who is a daycare provider, a 47-year-old daycare provider who has no criminal record whatsoever, was at a local tavern with a bunch of friends and her sister when she exited the bar to have a cigarette. She was immediately tackled by a gentleman who we now know as Officer Connell. She was body slammed to the ground. She was virtually lifted off of the ground and slammed to the ground in front of about approximately 10 to 15 witnesses. Eight of those witnesses we already have under oath in sworn statements who corroborate what I just recited, that she was actually body slammed out of nowhere by this officer, placed into handcuffs, face down to the ground. She was screaming for help. The crowd became enraged. They were basically screaming, you know, she didn't do anything, leave her alone, stop. And the officer called for backup from the Monroe County Sheriff's Department. I think because he felt cornered. I think he felt afraid of the crowd. In any event, the Sheriff's Department did arrive, and Ms. Arenas was lifted off the ground, put into the back of the police car, eventually taken to the emergency room of a local hospital, and suffered blunt trauma to her left shoulder, which was a rotator cuff surgery site, for which she's, you know, undergone physical therapy for, and underwent some great, you know, psychic trauma over that event, I think as anybody would. We filed a notice of claim, which is, you know, in the States, it's a statutory prerequisite that you file a notice of claim upon it. If you're going to intend to sue a municipality, you have to file a notice of claim within 90 days of the occurrence. Since the Village of East Rochester is indeed a municipality, that's what we did. In or about December, probably the last week of December, days after I filed that notice of claim with the Village of East Rochester, putting them on notice about what had occurred, got a phone call from a young lady called Samantha Hyman. Samantha Hyman was at first communicating solely with Ms. Arenas, and she was telling her that, yeah, well, Connell follows me around. He harasses me. At one instance, he took my head and put it into a snowbank, threatened to taser me, and basically calls me a fucking idiot and other choice expletives. Hyman is a intellectually challenged, mentally disabled female, 23, 24 years old. She's on Social Security disability. She lives with her mother. I said, well, have her call me. And I never thought much about it until February came around. And we received a phone call that Hyman had been placed into jail after she was tasered on her breasts and vagina. And I said, well, can't be. So I went over to the jail, and my colleague and I, Karen Sanders, who's an attorney in my firm, went into the jail, and I said, what happened? And she told me the story. that on one evening, February 2nd, she had contacted the police because she feared that her ex-boyfriend was attempting to sexually assault her. She called the police. Police came to the scene. They went to interview the alleged harasser. They came back 15 minutes later and told her, "We don't believe you." She said, "Well, fine, you don't believe me." From that point forward, the stories conflict. Her story is that they began to throw snowballs at her and basically were calling her a fucking idiot and this and that.
And is this a number of officers we're talking about then here?
No, this is the same officer. This is Officer Connell.
Okay.
Connell then followed her into her apartment building where she lives with her mother, grabbed her by the back of the neck. She fell over a bench that was in the hallway. She was on her back. He mounted her, essentially, had his knee in her sternum. Ms. Hyman, as a sidebar, is about 120 pounds, 5'5". Connell's about 300 pounds, 5'11". He then proceeded to taser her in the stun gun mode, what we call drive stun, on right above her labia, on her inner thigh. He then lifted her shirt up and then shot her on the breast, left breast. And from what the client indicates, from what Ms. Hyman indicates, that was the third shot. She said after the first shot, she basically was numb, that she could not move. She was terrified, of course. She does not recall how many times he shot her, but recounted in her 58, her municipal deposition hearing that she felt like she was on the ground for an hour. She doesn't know how many times she was shot. But what's very interesting and what has become an interesting development is that we have located the police report from that evening wherein Officer Connell seems to forget that he shot her in the pubic area and on her breast, but then indicates that he shot her twice in the abdomen. Oh. My perspective is, if he shot her twice in the abdomen and we have three other shots a week after, you know, she was tasered, I count five. At this point, we don't know how many times she was actually tasered, but we have received an order from the federal court, the Western District of New York, Honorable Judge Payson, Honorable Marion Payson, that orders the town of East Rochester to preserve the stun gun. Preserve the taser gun due to the fact that it contains weapon management technology within the data port.
Now you're talking about data that's made available through a computer download that keeps track of when and for how long the taser was deployed.
Right, and you could download it onto a simple Windows program. And when we made that motion, curiously, was by order to show cause, and the defendant's response was, "Well, we spilt mace on the taser, and we had to send it out to California."
Do you know the date that the mace was allegedly spilled?
Yeah, they're claiming that they had spilled mace on the taser gun a month earlier.
So after it was used on your client? Okay.
No, before it was used on my client.
Oh.
Yeah, they're claiming that they spilled mace on the gun, but then they continued to use it anyway, and then they just recently sent it to California, to Taser International, to be serviced, which I don't know how that's going to turn out. I guess when I get the data and I compare it to what the documentary evidence is, then we'll see where we go from there. But at this juncture, I have sought to have that piece of evidence, a very crucial piece of evidence, preserved.
Now, this evidence would be for a lawsuit which you have filed on behalf of both of the women who we've spoken of so far.
Correct.
Who are the defendants in this lawsuit other than, I'm guessing, Officer Connell would be one?
It would be the Village of East Rochester.
Okay.
The chief of police, his name is, I believe, David Pugliese. Another officer who was present while Ms. Hyman was being tasering but failed to intervene, his name is Officer Cranston. That's it.
Are you seeking an amount yet, or is that, is it premature?
No, I'm not seeking a, we're not seeking a dollar amount. I find that to be in bad taste personally, as a, it's not my style.
Okay.
You know, whatever the jury renders is going to be what the plaintiffs will you know, derive eventually. But no, we have not sought a dollar amount. We don't believe this is a dollar and cents issue. This is a morality issue. This is a civil rights issue. This is a propriety issue. This is an issue of what the Village of East Rochester taxpayers are getting for their tax dollar, which is apparently, you know, inimical behavior that's evil and misplaced and bullish and boorish, you know. So it's far more than money, you know.
Yes. I wanted to ask you before we get too far away from the facts. Have the police stated what their interest in? Well, I guess first of all with Teresa, because it seems to have, the attack on her seems to have come more or less out of the blue, as far as she's aware. Did the did Officer Connell at any time ever offer any justification for his actions?
Well, the story that occurred that evening is that indeed there was an altercation in the bar. An altercation is probably too serious a word. There was a cat fight of sorts between Arenas' sister Lola and another female in the bar that arose to the amount of screaming and yelling and pushing between two women. That was over, though, before that was finished, before Teresa had exited the bar and was standing outside there with her friends smoking a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably this officer, from what he indicates, felt as though Teresa was part of this catfight, and further explains that the reason why she fell to the ground is because his legs interlocked with hers.
Hmm.
And he fell on top of her.
Okay. And there's obviously little chance that that's actually the case. I guess
Well, I'll tell you something. They took that matter to trial in the local courts here. Disorderly conduct charge. She was charged with disorderly conduct, but she was not charged with resisting arrest. So the disorderly conduct went before the local judge, and of course they found in the town's favor, and Ms. Arenas was sanctioned 30 hours of community service before this, which we find deplorable, but, you know, there's no way that Teresa Arenas was going to accept, you know, a plea without taking the matter to trial and trying to demonstrate her innocence. I mean,
right.
That's just her sensibility.
I guess in both cases, there's the issue of whether the use of force by Officer Connell was justified. But in Samantha's case in particular, there seems to be a question of serious misuse of a taser device. I'm sure you're aware that tasers are under a lot of close scrutiny right now in Canada and the United States. It's been linked to a number of deaths. A number of police forces are questioning the safety, as is the U.S. Justice Department, U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission.
ACLU.
Yes, several coroners, right. Several coroners' inquests here in Canada, along with Amnesty International. So given your experience with Samantha, I was wondering if you've formed any of your own opinions about the use of stun gun technology by police.
I'll tell you one thing that seems to be absolutely for certain, and that is that, you know, the mentally disabled females, pregnant females, anyone who's of the weaker nature, of the weaker class, okay, as it could be construed, should really be wary. I think the potential for the misuse of this weaponry is so high. Look at what they did to this woman. They tasered her and they put her in jail because they figured that she would never be able to prove anything. And they knew that she couldn't get out of jail because they put a bond amount that she couldn't afford. And I think that it's pretty outrageous that they take people who, apparently from what I've been reading, who are mentally ill and somehow justify the use of that taser as a form of gaining compliance. I don't care, you know, I don't care if this woman was, you know, robbing a bank. I mean, there's no way to gain compliance from this person by tasering her in her sexual organs. That's not how you're going to gain compliance from her. It just seems like the incidents for abuse by these cops who wield these weapons is very high. And that's not to say that they couldn't be justifiable in some circumstances, but I fear for the weaker elements of society. You know, I really do. It just seems like it's, you know, I remember an ACLU case, which my case is seems to be forming into, where gentleman was shot, the officer claims, 17 times, and when they actually got the stun gun, it was more like 27 times. I mean, how could somebody be receiving 50,000 jolts of electricity 27 times through their body? I mean, it's a torture device is what it is, or what it could be used as.
Now,
and that's what my conclusion is lately.
Okay.
And I just, you know, let me tell you something. If you saw these pictures, it's like the sign of the devil. It's like seeing three sixes. You would lose it when you saw it.
Are we referring to the burn marks on Samantha?
Right, because of their location. I mean, they're right in her pubis. Mm. You know, right above her labia. You know, right on her breast. I mean, it looks like the marks of Satan. You know?
So what's next on the agenda then for your lawsuit? You've sent in your notice of claims. Are there any upcoming dates, or how is this going to go from this point on?
Well, we filed the lawsuit with the district court, the Western District Court of New York, and right now, after having gone through the order show cause to preserve certain pieces of evidence, we are now going to be entering the discovery stage where, you know, we're going to get these people to come in and testify and get experts to testify and analyze their documentary evidence and look at the stun gun in particular, look at the taser gun and analyze, A, whether or not the encrypted data has been somehow tampered with, and just to determine how many times this woman was actually shot.
So this is a process that will be ongoing for I guess the foreseeable future.
I think we'll be in discovery for about 12 months, and at that point, either the defendant is going to move to dismiss this case, or they're just virtually, you know, just going to go straight on to trial.
Or I suppose the third option is they could settle. But that's not looking.
Well, you know what? I don't. Their attitude is such that, you know, they're not in a settlement mode. Their mode is that we're lying, and we're manufacturing this, and that, you know, and they're going to stick with that.
Okay.
You know, it's going to be a very difficult battle. But you know, I am not the first complex piece of litigation I've been in the middle of, and it won't be the last. You know, so we're focusing on taking it all the way.
So far, Teresa Arenas has been convicted of disorderly conduct, and Samantha Hyman was just convicted on her charges of second-degree harassment and resisting arrest. We'll keep you up to date on what happens in this lawsuit. That's all for this week. Tune into this station for more next week. Email your comments and story ideas to ron@ckln.fm. And thanks to everyone who sent in material for this week's show. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich. Each week we end Bad Cop No Donut with a song. This week, it's Gang Control by Leftover Crack.